Hello and welcome to the APAC File, the joint bi-weekly podcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty and the Wilson Center focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. As the COVID-19 continues to challenge the world in the face of growing cases in Pakistan, the state and some of the influential stakeholders are at odds on how to manage this crisis. The primary disagreement appears to be around the social distancing rules where religious groups continue to gather for congregational prayers in defiance of the government order, and now Pakistani doctors are urging the government to take action against them. In the middle of all this, government appears to be indecisive. Now, with the holy month of Ramadan starting this week and the cost of lockdown getting evident economically, things are destined to heat up for the government of Imran Khan. So what is next in this crisis for the government? How it adds up to Prime Minister Imran Khan's growing list of challenges, and what are some of the scenarios and predictions about developments ahead? To discuss all these, I'm joined by Asad Hashim, Al Jazeera English's online correspondent in Pakistan, Madiha Afzal, the author of The Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism Society in the State, Michael Kugelman, Senior South Asia Fellow and the Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Asia Programs. Welcome on board, colleagues. So let's start with the latest development, Asad, which is the statement by the Pakistani Medical Association. They urged the government to impose restriction on mosques, and this statement is kind of prompted by the latest agreement between the government and religious groups, so which would allow the mosques to remain open. So let's talk about the doctor's statement. What was your reading of that?
Indeed. So last week, after a lot of back and forth and wrangling and actually a unilateral decision by religious leaders, more than a dozen of them across sectarian lines, to say that they were going to reopen the mosques unilaterally unless the government approached them and came to an agreement with them. So after a lot of back and forth with that, on Saturday and Sunday, senior religious leaders held talks with the prime minister and the president, and they came up with a 20-point plan that was to allow for the holding of congregational prayers and the reopening of mosques across the country according to certain social distancing guidelines. Now, a couple of days after that, or a day after that, the doctor's letter came through from a number of very senior doctors from across the country, people who are sort of epidemiologists and experts in that field. And mainly their concern, if you were to boil it down, it's quite a long letter and it deals with a lot of different questions, but mainly their concern is, you know, the guidelines are okay, but are they actually going to be followed at all? And given the way that people generally tend to, our traditional ways of acting in mosques, people are not going to be necessarily keeping to those rules. And moreover, during Taraweeh prayers, during the month of Ramadan, when there's a heightened number of people going to the mosque anyway, it's unrealistic to expect that you're going to actually see lower numbers and that you'll see lower mosque attendance. And so they have actually pleaded with the government to say, listen, this is going to create a new vector for spreading the coronavirus, and it's something that will very quickly spiral out of control. At a press conference on Wednesday, there was the number of about 70,000 being thrown around, is that if going on this course, then the number of cases could rise to about 70,000 by mid-May, and Pakistan only has about 3,500 or 3,600 ventilators, and the medics were basically saying that, you know, if at that point critical cases need ventilators, then there's not going to be enough, and so we need to do everything we can to depress the curve, and one of the major parts of that will be to stop all public gatherings, but particularly in mosques ahead of Ramadan.
Yeah. Asad, I also wondered how serious is this reaction by the doctors? I mean, what's the level of support for this statement overall in the country?
I think there's a difference between sort of the level of support that you might get from the general public and then the level of support that you might get from within government circles. And all of that boils down to who has power, who has political power, who has social power, and who has the power that political leaders are going to fear. And in this case, I don't think the doctors have any of that kind of power. They have science on their side. They appear to have the facts on their side, but that may not be enough in this situation because the government has time and again pandered to the religious right. And it always does in this case because of the vast social and political power that those groups hold, not necessarily in parliament, but to sway public opinion one way or another. And there's also, I mean, this is all inbuilt with a sense of fear. Politicians will always pander to them because there's a fear of being seen to be irreligious and to have their religious legitimacy taken away by the gatekeepers of that authority.
Since the statement is coming from the union, and is it the possibility that they go on strike? Doctors?
I doubt that will happen, but there is a different route for that to happen. So the doctors who released this statement are a group of doctors that are not necessarily organized as part of a union, but there is a very strong doctors union in Pakistan known as the Young Doctors Association, and that's primarily for young doctors and incoming medical professionals, but it does encompass quite a wide number of people. And the YDA has in fact been holding limited strikes and protests in Quetta, in Lahore. There were a number of arrests in Quetta a couple of weeks ago when they refused to go to work, saying that they were not being given enough PPE. In Lahore, there was a clash outside a government building last week as well. And so, yes, I think the YDA route might be the route that we would see for any kind of strike. And it is definitely possible if things continue to go on this trajectory. But I'm not sure that they would, even the YDA would use the religion route. They would probably use the idea that they're not being protected enough, that there's not enough protective gear, or that the health infrastructure is failing.
Right. Madiha, on the agreement between the religious groups and the government, though, I've been reading and rereading this 20-point memoranda. What do you make of it?
You know, I mean, they look good on paper, right? And that's it. They're completely impractical in terms of, you know, 6-foot distances between people at mosques, in terms of making sure there's hand sanitizer. How are people going to enter these mosques? Is it going to be in single file, 6 feet apart? Or are they just going to crowd into the mosque? How are they going to leave the mosque? Apparently, there are going to be no carpets at the mosque, no socializing. I mean, socializing at the mosque before and after prayers is one of the primary means of socializing. No ablutions at the mosque. Everybody wears masks. I mean, all of these sort of guidelines, it's sort of impractical to make sure that people remember to follow all of these at all times. And then the sheer magnitude of the number of mosques in the country and the fact that there are prayers being held 5 times a day in each of these mosques, the question of how you're going to actually enforce this is sort of insurmountable, essentially. I mean, and the Prime Minister just today actually just passed the buck on to the ulama to ensure enforcement, right? What are you going to do if people don't enforce it? He basically is saying, look, if people don't enforce these protocols and or, you know, sort of leaving this open and or if the virus spreads in the mosques, then we will have no choice but to close down mosques. I mean, in some ways, you know, it's almost a foregone conclusion that you're going to end up at a point where people are not going to follow these and the virus is going to spread because the virus is already spreading. And if it's spreading everywhere else, it's certainly going to spread in the mosques. So is the government, has it just issued these SOPs only to basically say, you know, a week down the road, look, this isn't working, we're going to have to roll this back? I think that we're going to have to wait and see what happens there.
Let's take, Michael, your point in that. I mean, why do you come up with this thing, Michael? I mean, what's the point here?
Well, I mean, clearly this agreement that the government came out with the religious leadership on was meant for the government to be able to say, well, look, we tried our best, we got a number of concessions. But indeed, as Madiha
concession
laid out,
on
it's
what,
going to be
Michael?
Very difficult.
I mean, concession on what? I mean, I've been reading this. I get the type of advice from my mom all the time. I don't touch your face and, you know, these things. And what kind of...
The idea that in theory there will be measures taken in these mosques to try to, you know, for instance, to have social distancing, to have people stand 6 feet apart. But indeed, as Madiha just noted, it's going to be very difficult to impose and enforce these measures. You know, I think a bit of context could be helpful here. I mean, as we've been discussing, the public health consequences of not shutting these mosques down, especially during the Ramadan period, could be very significant. And, you know, you do hear some say, well, you know, the numbers in Pakistan, the number of coronavirus cases and the number of deaths is nowhere near as high as you have in China and the U.S. and many countries in the West.
But how many tests are taking place, Michael, there? And that's another question.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the numbers right in front of me. And as of yesterday, there were about 10,500 confirmed cases in Pakistan. However, you know, what's troubling is that the numbers are rising exponentially. I mean, it seems that, you know, just over the last week or so alone, you've essentially had something close to increases of about 1,000 or so each day. So I think that this sort of accentuates the concern here that, you know, the government has indeed capitulated to the religious leadership and to the clerics. And there could well be very, very troubling and deadly public health consequences of not actually shutting down the mosques. Now, I mean, I think that the government has tried, but clearly it hasn't worked. And I think that, you know, the reason why we're seeing this resistance from the clerics is something that we've already discussed earlier on, that this is very political for the religious leadership. And they feel that they maintain their influence and their power by ensuring that they have large numbers of people coming to these mosques and hearing them out. And I think there's also a financial component to this as well, that particularly during Ramadan, you know, you get a lot of contributions and these mosques can make a lot of money. So it sounds sort of crude to put it in those terms, but I think that's an important point to put out there too. And finally, in terms of why doesn't the government just push harder and really put its foot down? Well, you know, clearly we know over the course of history in Pakistan that the religious factions are very powerful, and this goes goes back years, decades, and certainly to the 1980s when you had this Islamization policy implemented by Zia-ul-Haq that empowered religious figures and has led to the present day where they, you know, the government hesitates to move against them. And indeed, the government certainly worries about the risks if they go too far. You have religious leaders have the capacity to mobilize, get a lot of people out in the streets to protest.
Sure.
Certainly, they don't do well in elections, typically, they can get people out in the streets.
Yeah, Michael, sure. I mean, comparison between the Zia-ul-Haq era. I mean, today, the cost of not doing anything is way severe. I mean, look at this, the way this disease is spreading around the world. I mean, you let those people come together in thousands, like we have seen in the example of Tablighi Jamaat the other day in Lahore. I mean, what happened as an outcome of that? Let me bring in maybe Madiha. You have written a lot about this. I mean, what's the public perception of the way Imran Khan is handling this? I mean, yes, on the one hand, being decisive has a cost. Not being decisive has an even greater cost. So what people are talking about, I mean, looking into the media doesn't really give you a full picture of the local impression there.
So just a couple of points, you know, before we get into, you know, what people might think. There is a role for government here to shape behavior, right? Hmm. This is something that people have not dealt with before. And in some ways, you know, this entire pandemic has really put into sharp relief how Pakistan's politics works, right? Sort of the butting of heads between the government and the ulama. You know, the provincial governments have also come in here in this case, but sort of the butting of heads between the government and the ulama, which has been happening throughout Pakistan's history, you know, has come out in full force again in the midst of this pandemic. So it's really no surprise. But I think there were key points at which the government, while this is really very hard for all the reasons that have been already pointed out, this is a really hard problem. I mean, getting Pakistanis to not go to mosques is difficult, but there were key points at which the government could have put its foot down. You know, I think initially before the lockdowns were imposed, before the provincial governments went ahead and imposed those 5-person limits on congregations, you know, the government was sort of very soft on this, treading very lightly and calling the mufti in Cairo, sort of trying to build consensus, you know, asking for opinions all over. You know, Dr. Arif Alvi, the president, was doing this and then basically came out and said, look, guys, it's okay to pray at home. While in other countries, you know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, they've just gone ahead and shut down mosques. Yeah. But Pakistan has been really, really, the government did not do so until the provincial governments essentially stepped up and said, look, we're going to impose limits. Then again, you know, last week, as Ramadan was approaching, essentially the clerics went out and unilaterally said, look, we're going to hold congregations, right? Again, the government sort of waffled and said, look, we're going to do this consultation. And basically, the government is saying, look, we have no choice. We have to kind of go in for this middle ground. Imran Khan again said today, you know, the people want to go out and pray at mosques, got to come up with some middle ground. That's why we came up with these SOPs, essentially saying, look, we have no choice but to wring our hands and give in to what the people want. And it is true, Pakistanis will want to go to the mosques. And, you know, some of them will basically say, look, we actually need to be going to these mosques because at this time, because it is even more important. It is incumbent on us to pray at this time when the world is going through a public health crisis and we are in real danger. But I think, you know, we saw some people actually basically saying things like, if the government is not closing down mosques, I'm going to go to a mosque. So the idea is that the government has a role to play here in shutting things down, which it hasn't played. Now, one can say, look, Pakistan is a democracy, you know, the kind of authoritarian measures like shutting down mosques that Saudi Arabia took, that even Egypt took, you know, Pakistan can't take. And in fact, Imran Khan kind of invoked this just a couple of days ago, saying, look, we're an independent nation. We can't actually shut down mosques. I mean, that's a little rich, right? Coming from a country where, sure, it is a democracy, but there are a lot of curbs on individual freedoms. And in some sense, this is, you know, it's a nice excuse to say that this is a democracy, so we can't do that. So look, I think the people want to go out and pray. People are religious, sure, but there's a role for government that has not been taken up by Imran Khan.
Yeah, Asad, on the government's role here. I mean, we've seen there were some actions were taken earlier. We have seen soldiers trying to enforce the order of the day in terms of the COVID-19. What happened? What was the breaking point in which Imran Khan kind of of stepped back from all this.
So if we're going to talk about the civil-military aspect of this, then obviously there was only losses to be had from the army stepping in initially, and they probably wanted to let it go because at that point it's a reputational risk for them, right? And the army in Pakistan traditionally takes, especially in this hybrid regime that we've had for the last few years, takes the role of kind of letting the civilian government be the face of it, particularly when things are quite bad. And I think early on it was very clear that, you know, things are going to get bad in Pakistan, and so the army took a back seat. But as cases began to spike and as it became clear that there was a lot of waffling, like, I mean, at one point Imran Khan was refusing to disburse money to the provinces in order to help them set up quarantine centers because they were quibbling over money and funding, saying, oh, the provinces should pay for it themselves. And I think that was the time when the NDMA, so the National Disaster Management Authority, was given the lead role. And I'm pretty sure it was not from the civilian government alone that that order came from. That the NDMA, of course, is headed by a serving Lieutenant General of the Army. And so they have taken a stronger role now. And you're hearing a lot more pronouncements coming from General Bajwa, the Chief of Army Staff's office as well, about this. I want to talk a little bit about speak to the points that I think that Madhya just raised as well, a little bit about sort of the idea of like being able to shut down things the way that has happened in Saudi Arabia or has happened in other places, in the Gulf countries, notably in Kuwait, etc. I think what's important to talk about here, and Madhya knows a lot more about this than I do, is the political economy of the religious right in Pakistan. And what's very different about Pakistan as opposed to those other states is that there is no centralized authority when it comes to shutting down these mosques. The government doesn't control the mosques almost at all. I mean, the best example of this is the Lal Masjid in Islamabad, which is nominally a government-controlled mosque. It's technically the khatib of this mosque is nominated and assigned by the government, the federal government. But the current incumbent in that position is Maulana Abdul Aziz, who once went to war with the state of Pakistan and continues to hold Friday prayers. I was there last week just to have a sense of what was going on. And there were hundreds of people crammed into the Lal Masjid in complete and total defiance of the government's orders. So there is a little bit of a lack of centralized authority. And I think the other thing with lockdowns is that they're only really as effective as the public's willingness to abide by them and to be guided by them. And so a lockdown order is not necessarily so much a lockdown order as it is also a signal from the government, right? So if a government says, listen, we are at a very, very serious level of concern and we need to shut everything down, they're not necessarily going to be able to arrest everybody who breaks that curfew, but they can send the signal that things are very, very bad. And what Imran Khan's government, I think, has done by easing the lockdown, not just for mosques, but for other industries as well last week, was send a signal to the economy and to the public at large that things are easing off now and things are not so bad, which is at complete odds with the numbers and the number of deaths and the number of cases that we're seeing. As Michael pointed out, we've had two of the three highest days of single day rises have been yesterday and on Monday. And the number is now beginning to climb exponentially in terms of cases. Part of that is because we're testing more, but a lot of that also has to do with the fact that the virus is now at the super spreader stage. And so you've got to keep those things in mind as well, I think. And lastly, on the political economy of the religious right, I think, as Michael pointed out, there is an issue of finances that is at the heart of all of this. And I think we can't ignore that. When PM Khan met the religious leaders on Monday, he told them that mosque workers would be included in a government economic stimulus package, in a bailout package, that utility bills for mosque would be waived. Earlier in a meeting with the president, religious leaders were told that, and apparently the ulama, this was one of their main concerns, was that if the mosque will be closed, then there's going to be a major shift of donations and philanthropic donations coming in, and they won't go through mosques. They will instead go through secular organizations such as the Eidi Foundation, etc. So the finances are at the heart of this. But there's an even more fundamental question here is, and this is where it gets a little bit woolly, I guess, or maybe anthropological, is it's a question of religion's role in people's lives, right? Right? Arguably, this is precisely the time, at a time of crisis, when religion requires that its adherents need to turn towards it rather than kind of turn towards their own way. And if you put up barriers between the state and organized religion in particular at a time like this, then people might stay religious, but they might not necessarily come back to the organized part of it when it is all over. Mosque attendance, I would expect, would go down if there was an extended period of mosques being shut down. And I think mosques and the entire associated political economy with it realize this, and they know that they might become irrelevant if they accept being sidelined at a time like this.
Yeah, very interesting.
If I can just add on one quick point there. I think the notion of sort of this centralized authority on religion is really an important one that Asad pointed out. And it's really fascinating how obviously Pakistan, while, you know, it is an Islamic republic, it has a democracy where no Islamist party has even ever won more than a few seats in parliament. And so certainly there is always been a tussle between the civilian government and the religious right, that includes Islamist parties, but also includes the ulama and so on. So interestingly, in Pakistan, the Council of Islamic Ideology, the Pakistan Ulama Council, those folks who are sort of considered to be allied with the government, the religious right that is allied with the government, even that has struggled to get the point across to the sort of the more fundamentalist religious right, if you will. And one interesting comparison that can be drawn is with the United States, right? So the fact that churches have not been shut down in the U.S., right? Again, a democratic country, you know, you can't really shut churches down. But most churches, most places of religious worship have shut down themselves. But there are some evangelical churches which have refused to shut down and are still holding mass. Now, really interestingly, because those evangelical churches form part of Donald Trump's base, he has been hesitant to call them out. You know, this is, you know, partly similar to what plays out in Pakistan. So it's not about one religion, but it's about religion, politics, and power and how they interact.
Right. On the messages, though, Madiha, Imran Khan was meeting with a number of people there, with ulama and all these religious figures. Was he meeting the right people there, right messengers?
You know, I think Imran Khan overall, what he has been trying to do is tread lightly when it comes to the religious right. And look, this is an instinct that it's not only Imran Khan who has had this instinct. You know, each of Pakistan's civilian leaders have had this instinct, ranging from Zulfikar Ali Bhutto to Nawaz Sharif to Benazir Bhutto, now to Imran Khan, right? And so I understand the instinct. I know where it derives from. However, I will say that Imran Khan actually, perhaps treading sort of more softly than he needs to, he has some, you know, Islamic sort of credentials, some legitimacy from the religious right that he can use. I mean, he deployed it quite effectively to shut down the Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, you know, after waffling on them initially in the November 2018 protests. He shut down the group, arrested, made sure that all the members were arrested. I mean, obviously there's a key there, and the key is that they threatened the Pakistan army. And so perhaps he had backing to be able to do that. But I think he definitely has more sort of Islamic credentials than, for instance, Benazir Bhutto did in terms of what people perceive of him. And so he can actually go a little bit further than he actually does in taking some steps. But he likes to build consensus. I think what they're trying to do, look, we tried. If it doesn't work, we're going to have to shut this down. But we tried our very best.
Yeah, it's tough out there, Madiha. So on one hand, you are dealing with the immediate health crisis. On the other hand, keeping the country under lockdown will also have an economic consequences. And also, these are on the top of many other crises that Imran Khan's government is currently facing. So let's keep talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the APAC File podcast. I'm joined by Asad Hashim, Al Jazeera English's online correspondent in Pakistan, Madiha Afzal, the author of Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society in the State, Michael Kugelman, Senior South Asia Fellow and the Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Asia Programs here in Washington, D.C. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberty's Media Manager and host of the APAC File podcast. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So, Michael, let me start with you here. In terms of the management of this issue, let me be straightforward here. Do you think Imran Khan can manage this? I mean, it is not, as I said, it's not the health crisis anymore. He also needs to navigate way out from the economic consequences of continued lockdown. No one seems to be happy about the way he is handling this situation. I went through the Dawn article today, and the article doesn't give you much, but the comments that you read at the bottom of that article gives you various ideas in terms of how people are frustrated the way things are at the moment in the country. So can Imran Khan manage this crisis?
Yeah, good question. Though I'm not sure if comments posted on Dawn's website are indicative of Pakistani thinking on the whole, given Dawn's reputation as being one of the few outlets that's always critical of the state and particularly Imran Khan. But no, you get to an important point, Mohammed, that for quite some time, Imran Khan has been under a fair amount of pressure, certainly from large sections of the public, but even those who support the PTI, that he simply is coming across as an inexperienced leader who's in over his head and is not even before the pandemic, was struggling to tackle what had been a stubborn economic crisis that he generally inherited from the last governments, but still had been unable to fix, particularly a debt crisis that had been quite severe during the last final months of the previous government, and a crisis that his government had managed to ease a bit, but certainly had not come close to eliminating. I was last in Pakistan myself in February, and I spoke to a number of avowed supporters of the ruling party. And they all said the same thing. They said that he really is not doing a good job. They used the word incompetent, that he was not in a position to do this. And now, of course, we have the pandemic, which is a complex national emergency that even the best government out there would struggle to curb. And then you have Imran Khan, who's inexperienced. This gets to the civil-military issue again that we sort of got into a bit earlier. I think it's quite clear that over the last year or so, the military has quietly been stepping up its role in policy, taking on an even greater role than it typically takes, particularly in terms of tackling the economy. You had a new economic commission that was formed in which the army chief had a seat at the table. And I think now as well, there's indications that the army is playing a considerable role in trying to tackle this crisis. And I think that Imran Khan himself just stated in this telethon that he was participating in earlier today, the tactics that the ISI has used for tracing terrorists are being used for contact tracing. And I imagine the ISI itself was probably involved in that very process. So it may be, the question is, can Imran Khan handle it? I think in of itself, the simple answer is no, he's in over his head. But I think that he is perfectly happy to defer to a larger military role in combating this this pandemic. Now, the tricky issue gets to whether, you know, we get into the next week or two and Ramadan is in place and you have huge numbers of people going to mosques and the government tries to get the religious leadership to scale back and to try to get more people not to go to the mosque and the religious leadership digs its heels in. Then what happens? I mean, then do you deploy troops in front of mosques to try to limit people to go in? I don't think that would happen, but if it comes to that could get to some very dicey and very tricky issues. But my sense, bottom line, is that the prime minister is in over his head. But the good thing for him and for the country is that he does have the army trying to get more involved in playing a governance role. This is not new. This has happened in the past when you have earthquakes, things like that. Certainly, it raises concerning questions about democracy. But at a time like this, I think democracy is sort of plays second fiddle to the issue of governance and public health and getting out there to do whatever's necessary to prevent this pandemic from getting worse in Pakistan.
I wondered, Asad, also your point in that. I mean, my good friend Dawood Khatak, our Radio Mashal of our Pakistan service, Radio Free Radio Liberty, he had a recent story also. Let me give him a shout out here, even going as far as whether he can survive this.
Yeah, I think that is a very valid question. In fact, that was something I was going to throw to Michael as well, because I'd like to hear his view on it. Is I think as we get further and further and deeper into this crisis, and as you say, when we get to the point where, you know, undoubtedly it seems a pretty scientific prediction that we can make here is that, like, as more and more congregants gather at mosques, the numbers are going to skyrocket, not just because of that, but also that's the trajectory Pakistan's already on. You know, when does it get to a point where, or does it get to a point where the military wants to step in actually explicitly? Is that something that we're going to see? I think we're very much on a road towards it, but I don't think that's... The military has indicated a preference towards not taking that path, specifically in the last 3 years, even with Imran's predecessor, with Nawaz Sharif. You saw Raheel Sharif, the previous army chief, taking a more hybrid approach, trying to run things behind the scenes without being out in front. I think that is the preference of the military, but at some point when push comes to shove, it's unclear. But we're definitely in a place where that could happen, and I would not have said that, you know, a year ago.
Madiha, is there anything you want to add in this?
Sure, yes. Actually, so I'll take a little bit of a different tack from my colleagues here, which is that I think, sure, this is obviously an unprecedented health crisis that is exposing the limits of, you know, leadership and decision-making and governance all over the world, including where we are right now, the United States. But a couple of things. In Pakistan, I think it has also given the provinces an opportunity to step up. And, you know, thanks to the 18th Amendment, the provinces control health and education and other matters in Pakistan much more than they used to. And hence, you know, they've actually stepped up in many ways. This gives the government an opportunity to iron out those responsibilities even further and divide them. And in some sense, actually has left a little bit less space for the military to step in than otherwise would have been the case. So if you had an incompetent federal government before 2020, 2010, the military would have had more opportunity to step in. Now you actually are giving the provinces an opportunity to step in. So that's one thing I would add. And then the other thing is, I think this crisis has also, so while Imran Khan has been sort of all too happy to let the military and the provinces kind of take the lead on the lockdown, right? He's talked much more about relief. That goes exactly to serve his populist sort of rhetoric and his populist sort of persona. And so, you know, the Ehsaas program, rolling out that and giving 12,000 rupees to needy families, and sort of, you know, his government has been very, very focused on that front. That has enabled him to sort of really show that side of his in sharp relief. And again, I think for some Pakistanis, you know, that is going to be something that they reward him for.
You know, again, it's not over yet. I mean, these challenges, but perhaps maybe we are just at the beginning of this. Now, health crisis is what we are talking about today, but again, it will follow the economic challenges, and it preceded like a sugar scandal involving very close circle of Imran Khan. So there are so many challenges that we are talking about here. So just to wrap up here, so what's the way out for Imran Khan from all this, the way it stands today, Michael?
Now, that's a great question to end on. Let me just make one more point before I get to that, or two others. I think I don't want to overstate the civil-military issue here. I don't want to overstate the issue of civil-military tensions. I mean, as I tried to articulate before, I think that the two generally see eye to eye. The prime minister is happy to defer to the army in terms of its stepped-up role in this crisis. And I do not think that we have to look to the possibility, even if the pandemic really gets bad in Pakistan, that Imran Khan could be showed the door, just because who would replace him? I think that's the big question. If there's some arrangement where he's basically told he has to step down, I don't think there's any logical candidate to become the next prime minister. So I think that he's going to be perfectly fine, even though he'll continue to lose policy space. Though I think at least now during this emergency period, he's perfectly fine with that.
Maybe, Michael, he stays there, but then in what shape he's going to come out of this?
Right. Well, I don't want to go into this too much, but you know, I think that the army feels that he has done a very good job representing Pakistan on the world stage. Particularly in terms of how he's tried to bring attention to Kashmir and how he has tried to project himself to the international community as a more peace-loving, responsible leader than Narendra Modi. I think the army is very on board with that, and they see Imran as someone who's charismatic and can win people over overseas, which is not has not been typical for civilian leaders in Pakistan during the recent past. But anyway, the other quick point to make is that, you know, there have been some success stories here. I mean, there have been cases of mosques that have shut down or that have done a much better job than others of limiting the numbers of people that have come in. And I believe Assad last week or a few days ago posted some photos on Twitter in which there was clear that some congregations, there weren't really that many people there at all. So, you know, the question here is why is that? I mean, why do you have some cases of mosques that are more willing to do whatever is necessary to limit the spread of COVID and to do more social distancing? I mean, is it just the personalities of those in charge there or what? For me, that's an interesting question. But in terms of the way forward, it's going to be a very difficult few weeks. I think the next few days, the next week or two could be critical for Pakistan because, as we've discussed, the super spreader period is upon us. The number of confirmed cases are rising. And so I think we'll get a sense of just how bad this could get, especially when you have these large crowds in mosques. I think there'll be a lot more pressure on the government to try to put more pressure on the religious leadership. And I think we'll get a better idea in the next few weeks where things could be going on that front.
Okay, we started this discussion. Of course, we should end it on a health-related note. So in terms of the handling of this, Assad, where your eyes will be to determine how things are going forward?
Yeah, so I think one of the anomalies that's sprung up in the data as compared to a lot of different countries, I've been compiling my own list of the data and kind of like charting progress every day. And one of the places where Pakistan is actually doing quite well as opposed to other countries around the world is not only is the lockdown definitely slowed down the spread and we didn't get to a exponential increase as quickly as some other countries did, like the UK, France, Germany, the US, etc., Italy, of course. So we did slow that down a bit. But one of the other places where Pakistan has done extremely well so far is actually on the question of deaths. So the mortality rate and the fatality rate in Pakistan has actually been far lower for COVID-related deaths than it has been anywhere else. And one of the best examples I can give of this is, so Pakistan and Mexico have been on almost exactly the same trajectory in terms of the number of cases and in terms of general kind of response. Currently, as of today, Pakistan is 10,513, Mexico is 10,544. But Mexico has 970 deaths so far, and Pakistan has 222 or so. Now, part of this might be that there's not enough data, that it's that the data is not clean necessarily, but you can't see that big a discrepancy just from the data. And there was some talk last week about more dead bodies coming into the ETH Foundation, which is a philanthropic organization, or into hospitals in Karachi. But following that report, I made some calls to major government hospitals in Quetta, in Lahore, in other parts of Karachi, in Islamabad, and none of those other cities were reporting those heightened number of cases of dead bodies coming in, which could possibly have been infection-related, COVID-related cases causing a spike of other deaths. So it seems like, for now, Pakistan's death rate is low, and my eye is going to be on when that number begins to spike, when and if it does. Is Pakistan at this point, I think, over-reliant on the idea, and I think Pakistan's policy response as well, is over-reliant on the idea that it's a relatively young population, which is true, and that, you know, maybe if it does go to a vast degree of spread, that most people will be able to kind of weather through it without even necessarily having that many critical cases. My eye is going to be on the number of deaths, to be honest, and looking at when and if we get to a point where hospital morgues are beginning to overflow. Those are calls that I'm making regularly just to check to see if that's already happening and it's not being reported. So far, we haven't hit it, it seems.
Okay. Madiha, finally, where your eyes will be, I mean, to determine how he is handling this health crisis in where we are headed going forward.
I mean, I think there are a lot of uncertainties, right? You know, as Asad just pointed out, sort of trying to figure out, does Pakistan have a low death rate compared to other countries, you know, because of the younger population? And there are some myths going around in Pakistan as well, sort of debunking those myths, right? That previous rounds of vaccination against certain diseases essentially has made the Pakistani population in some way immune to the spread. And so people are now considering after 1 month, just like relaxing the lockdown. And just recently, we've seen the Karachi Traders Associations basically saying, look, we are not going to stay home during Ramadan. We actually need to go out and open our shops. These are all very difficult problems to handle. You know, we don't actually know the science of this pandemic until and how it affects different populations until, you know, we see it go through one season. So I think the key with this kind of pandemic is obviously to be extremely risk averse and to be extremely proactive. That has its costs, especially in a very, very poor society and a very poor country. But I think what is really important here is a clear, clean, direct narrative, right, coming from the top, which has been missing so far. Look, you know, we cannot ease social distancing. You know, we're going to open up some parts of the economy, but not everything. The mosque SOPs are obviously a really worrisome point because is it necessary to pray in mosques? You know, that is a question. I mean, fine, it may be necessary for a daily wage earner to go out and earn money, but to survive. But mosques don't call for that same sort of level of necessity. Right. So with that, the government has already kind of shot itself in the foot, but it needs a clear, clean narrative going forward about the necessity of a lockdown, the necessity of taking this seriously while we see how it develops. And I think the one final thing I'll say is that doctors and the doctors coming out and very forcefully issuing statements have given the government a way out when it comes to mosques, right? Because in Pakistani society, doctors are very, very well respected. You know, it's sort of they're treated almost with reverence. And so if the government is kind of serious about this situation, it may actually behoove it to take the advice of the doctors and actually try to shut down mosques. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I doubt the narrative is going to get any clearer in the coming week or two, which is crucial, than it has been in the last few weeks.
Michael, I think we kind of covered quite a lot of ground here. Is there anything that I have missed and you want to add? Otherwise, I'm going to conclude the discussion here.
No, I think we've said it all. This has been a terrific discussion, so I'll let you conclude.
Great. Thank you very much. Madiha Afzal, the author of the Pakistan Under Siege Extremism Society in the State. Asad Hashim, Al Jazeera English's online correspondent in Pakistan. Michael Kugelman, Senior South Asia Fellow and the Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Asia Programs. Thank you very much, colleagues, for being part of the show today. And so from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Media Manager and host of the APAC File, a joint podcast series of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty and the Wilson Center. Please join us in 2 weeks. Until then, bye-bye.